Disc 6.
Chapter 19. The memo arrived by fax from the Regional Supervisor, Bureau of Prisons, Washington. It was directed to M. Emmett Brune, the warden of Trumbull. In terse but standard language, the supervisor said he'd reviewed the logs from Trumbull and was bothered by the number of visits by one Trevor Carson, attorney for three of the inmates. Lawyer Carson had reached the point of logging in almost every day. While every inmate certainly had a constitutional right to meet with his attorney, the prison likewise had the power to regulate the traffic. Beginning immediately, attorney-client visits would be restricted to Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays between the hours of 3 and 6 p.m. Exceptions would be granted liberally for good cause shown. The new policy would be utilized for a period of 90 days, after which time it would be reviewed. Fine with the warden. He, too, had grown suspicious of Trevor's almost daily appearances. He'd questioned the front desk and the guards in a vain effort to determine what exactly was the nature of all this legal work. Link, the guard who usually escorted Trevor to the conference room and who usually pocketed a couple of 20s on each visit, told the warden that the lawyer and Mr. Spicer talked about cases and appeals and such. "Just a bunch of law crap," Link said.
"And you always search his briefcase?" the warden had asked.
"Always," Link had replied. Out of courtesy, the warden dialed the number of Mr. Trevor Carson in Neptune Beach. The phone was answered by a woman who said rudely,
"Law office.
Mr. Trevor Carson, please."
"Who's calling?"
"This is Emmett Brune."
"Well, Mr. Brune, he's taking a nap right now."
"I see. Could you possibly wake him? I'm the warden at the federal prison in Trumbull, and I need to speak with him."
"Just a minute."
He waited for a long time, and when she returned, she said,
"I'm sorry I couldn't wake him up. Could I have him return your call?"
"No, thank you. I'll just fax him a note."
The idea of a reverse scam was hatched by York while playing golf on a Sunday. And as his game progressed, occasionally on the fairways, but more often in the sand and trees, the scheme grew and grew and became brilliant. He abandoned his pals after 14 holes and called Teddy. They would learn the tactics of their adversaries, and they could divert attention away from Al Conyers. There was nothing to lose. The letter was created by York and assigned to one of the top forgers in documents. The pen pal was christened Brant White, and the first note was handwritten on a plain white but expensive correspondence card. "Dear Ricky, saw your ad. Liked it. I'm 55, in great shape, and looking for more than a pen pal. My wife and I just bought a home in Palm Valley, not far from Neptune Beach. We'll be down in 3 weeks with plans to stay for 2 months. If interested, send photo. If I like what I see, then I'll give more details. Brant." The return address was from Brant, P.O., Box 88645, Upper Darby, P.A., 19082. To save 2 or 3 days, a Philadelphia postmark was applied in documents, and the letter was flown to Jacksonville, where Agent Klockner himself delivered it to Aladdin North's little box in the Neptune Beach post office. It was a Monday. After his nap the following day, Trevor picked up the mail and headed west, out of Jacksonville, along the familiar route to Trumbull. He was greeted by the same guards, Mackie and Vince, at the front door, and he signed the same logbook Rufus shoved in front of him. He followed Link into the visitor's area and to a corner where Spicer was waiting in one of the small attorney conference rooms.
"I'm catching some heat," Link said as they stepped into the room.
Spicer did not look up. Trevor handed 2 20s to Link, who took them in a flash.
"From who?"
Trevor asked, opening his briefcase. Spicer was reading a newspaper.
"The warden?"
"Hell, he's cut back on my visits. What else does he want?"
"Don't you understand?" Spicer said without lowering the newspaper. "Link here's upset because he's not collecting as much. Right, Link?"
"You got that right.
I don't know what kind of funny business you boys are running here, but if I tightened up on my inspections, you'd be in trouble, wouldn't you?
You're being paid well, Trevor said.
That's what you think.
How much do you want? Spicer said, staring at him now.
$1,000 a month, cash, he said, looking at Trevor. I'll pick it up at your office.
$1,000 and the mail doesn't get checked, Spicer said.
Yep.
And not a word to anybody.
Yep.
It's a deal. Now get out of here.
Link smiled at both of them and left the room. He positioned himself outside the door and, for the benefit of the closed-circuit cameras, looked through the window occasionally. Inside, the routine varied little. The exchange of mail happened first and took only a second. From a worn manila folder, the same one every time, Joe Roy Spicer removed the outgoing letters and handed them to Trevor, who took the incoming mail from his briefcase and gave it to his client. There were 6 letters to be mailed. Some days there were as many as 10, never less than 5. Though Trevor didn't keep records or copies or documents in a file that would serve as proof that he had anything whatsoever to do with the Brethren's little scam, he knew there had to be 20 or 30 potential victims currently being set up. He recognized some of the names and addresses. 21, to be exact, according to Spicer's precise records. 21 serious prospects, with another 18 who were marginal. Almost 40 pen pals, currently hiding in their various closets, some terrified of their shadows, others getting bolder by the week, still others on the verge of kicking down the door and dashing off to meet Ricky or Percy. The difficult part was being patient. The scam was working, money was changing hands, the temptation was to squeeze them too quickly. Beach and Yarber were proving to be workhorses, laboring over their letters for hours at a time, while Spicer directed operations. It took discipline to hook a new pen pal, one with money, then ply him with enough pretty words to earn his trust.
"Aren't we due for a bust?" Trevor said.
Spicer was flipping through the new letters.
"Don't tell me you're broke," he said. "You're making more than we are."
My money's tucked away, just like yours. I'd just like to have some more of it.
So would I.
Spicer looked at the envelope from Brant in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania.
Ah, a new one, he mumbled to himself, then opened it.
He read it quickly and was surprised by its tone. No fear, no wasted words, no peeking around corners. This man was ready for action.
Where's Palm Valley? He asked.
10 miles south of the beaches, why?
What kind of place is it?
It's one of the gated golf communities for rich retirees, almost all from up north.
How much are the houses?
Well, I've never been there, okay? They keep the damned gate locked, guards everywhere, like somebody might break in and steal their golf carts.
But how much are the houses?
Nothing less than 1 million. I've seen a couple advertised for 3 million.
Wait here.
Spicer said, gathering his file and walking to the door.
Where are you going? Trevor asked.
To the library. I'll be back in half an hour.
I got things to do.
No, you don't. Read the newspaper.
Spicer said something to Link, who escorted him through the visitor's area and out of the administration building. He walked quickly along the manicured grounds. The sun was warm, and the gardeners were earning their 50 cents an hour. So were the keepers of the law library. Beach and Yarber were hiding in their little conference room, taking a break from their writings with a game of chess, when Spicer entered in a rush with an uncharacteristic smile.
"Boys, we finally hooked the big one," he said,
and tossed Brant's letter on the table. Beach read it aloud.
"Palm Valley is one of the golf communities for rich folks," Spicer explained proudly. "Houses go for about 3 million. The boy's got plenty of dough and he ain't much for letters."
"He does seem anxious," Yarber observed.
"We need to move fast," Spicer said. "He wants to come down in 3 weeks.
"What's the upside potential?" Beach asked.
He loved the jargon of those who invested millions.
"At least 500,000, Spicer said. "Let's do the letter now. Trevor is waiting."
Beach opened one of his many files and displayed his wares, sheets of paper in soft pastels.
"I think I'll try the peach," he said.
"Oh, definitely," Spicer said. "Gotta do peach."
Ricky wrote a scaled-down version of the initial contact letter. 28 years old, college graduate, locked down in rehab but on the verge of release, probably in 10 days, very lonely, looking for a mature man to start a relationship. How convenient that Brandt would be living nearby, because Ricky had a sister in Jacksonville, and he'd be staying with her. There were no obstacles, no hurdles to cross. He'd be ready for Brandt when he came south. But he'd like a photo first. Was Brandt really married? Would his wife be living at Palm Valley too, or would she stay up there in Pennsylvania? Wouldn't it be great if she did? They enclosed the same color photo they'd used 100 times. It had proved to be irresistible. The peach envelope was taken by Spicer back to the attorney conference room where Trevor was napping.
"Mail this immediately," Spicer barked at him.
They spent 10 minutes on their basketball bets, then said goodbye without a handshake. Driving back to Jacksonville, Trevor called his bookie, a new one, a bigger bookie now that he was a player. The digital line was indeed more secure, but the phone wasn't. Agent Klockner and his band of operatives were listening as usual and tracking Trevor's bets. He wasn't doing badly, up $4,500 in the past 2 weeks. By contrast, his law firm had put $800 on the books during the same period. In addition to the phone, there were 4 mics in the Beetle, most of them of little value but operational nonetheless. And under each bumper was a transmitter, both wired to the car's electrical system and checked every other night when Trevor was either drinking or sleeping. A powerful receiver in the rental across the street tracked the Beetle wherever it went. As Trevor puttered down the highway, talking on his phone like a big shot, tossing money around like a Vegas high roller, sipping scalded coffee from a Quick Stop grocery, he was emitting more signals than most private jets. March 7th. Big Super Tuesday. 2 hours after the polls closed in New York, Aaron Lake bounced triumphantly across the stage in a large banquet room of a Manhattan hotel, while thousands cheered and music roared and balloons fell from above. He'd taken New York with 43% of the vote. Governor Terry had a rather weak 29%, and the other also-rans got the rest. Lake hugged people he'd never seen before and waved to people he'd never see again, and he delivered without notes a stirring victory speech. Then he was off, on his way to L.A. for another victory celebration. For 4 hours in his new Boeing jet that would hold 100 and leased for $1 million a month and flew at a speed of 500 miles per hour, 38,000 feet above the country, he and his staff monitored the returns from the 12 states participating in Big Super Tuesday. Along the East Coast, where the polls had already closed, Lake barely won in Maine and Connecticut, but put up big margins in New York, Massachusetts, Maryland, and Georgia. He lost Rhode Island by 800 votes and won Vermont by 1,000. As he was flying over Missouri, CNN declared him the winner of that state by 4 percentage points over Governor Terry. Ohio was just as close. By the time Lake reached California, the rout was over. Of the 591 delegates at stake, he'd captured 390. He'd also solidified the momentum. And most important, Aaron Lake now had the money. Governor Terry was falling hard and fast, and all bets were on Lake. Chapter 20. 6 hours after claiming victory in California, Lake awoke to a frenzied morning of live interviews. He suffered through 18 in 2 hours, then flew to Washington. He went straight to his new campaign headquarters on the ground floor of a large office building on H Street, a stone's throw from the White House. He thanked his workers, almost none of whom were volunteers.
He worked his crowd, shook their hands, all the while asking himself, "Where did these people come from?" "We're gonna win," he said over and over, and everybody believed it. Why not? He met for an hour with his top people. He had $65 million, no debt. Terry had less than $1 million on hand, and he was still trying to count the money he owed. In fact, the Terry campaign had missed a federal filing deadline because its books were in such a mess. All cash had vanished. Contributions had stopped. Lake was getting all the money. The names of three potential vice presidents were debated with great enthusiasm. It was an exhilarating exercise because it meant the nomination was in the bag. Lake's first choice, Senator Nance from Michigan, was drawing fire because he'd had some shady business deals in another life. His partners had been of Italian extraction from Detroit, and Lake could close his eyes and see the press peeling skin off Nance. A committee was appointed to explore the issue further. And a committee was appointed to begin planning Lake's presence at the convention in Denver. Lake wanted a new speechwriter now, and he wanted him working on the acceptance speech. Lake secretly marveled at his own overhead. His campaign chairman was getting $150,000 for the year, not for 12 months, but until Christmas. There was a chairman of finance, of policy, of media relations, of operations, and of strategic planning, and all had contracts for $120,000 for about 10 months of work. Each chairman had two or three immediate underlings, people Lake hardly knew, and they earned $90,000 apiece. Then there were the campaign assistants, or CAs, not the volunteers that most candidates attracted, but real employees who earned $50,000 each and kept the offices in a frenzy. There were dozens of them, and dozens of clerks and secretaries, and hell, nobody made less than $40,000. And on top of all this waste, Lake kept telling himself, if I make it to the White House, then I'll have to find jobs for them there. Every damned one of them. Kids now running around with Lake buttons on every lapel will expect to have West Wing clearances and jobs paying $80,000 a year. It's a drop in the bucket, he kept reminding himself. Don't get hung up on the small stuff when so much more is at stake. Negatives were pushed to the end of the meeting and given short shrift. A reporter for the Post had been digging into Lake's early business career. Without too much effort, he'd stumbled upon the Green Tree Mess, a failed land development 22 years in the past. Lake and a partner had bankrupted Green Tree, legally shafting creditors out of $800,000. The partner had been indicted for bankruptcy fraud, but a jury let him walk. No one laid a glove on Lake, and seven times after that, the people of Arizona elected him to Congress. "I'll answer any question about Green Tree," Lake said. "It was just a bad business deal." "The press is about to shift gears," said the chairman of media relations. "You're new and you haven't been subjected to enough scrutiny. It's time for them to get nasty." "It's already started," Lake said. "I have no skeletons." For an early dinner, he was whisked away to Mortimer's, the current power place to be seen, just down Pennsylvania, where he met Elaine Tyner, the lawyer now running DPAC. Over fruit and cottage cheese, she laid out the current financials of the newest PAC on the block. Cash in hand of $29 million, no significant debt, money being churned around the clock, coming in from all directions, from everywhere in the world. Spending it was the challenge. Since it was considered soft money, or money that couldn't go directly to the Lake campaign, it had to be used elsewhere. Tyner had several targets. The first was a series of generic ads similar to the Doomsday ads Teddy had put together. DPAC was already buying primetime spots for the fall. The second, and by far the most enjoyable, were the Senate and congressional races. "They're lining up like ants," she said with great amusement. "It's amazing what a few million bucks can do." She told the story of a House race in a district in Northern California where the incumbent, a 20-year veteran Lake knew and despised, started the year with a 40-point lead against an unknown challenger.
The unknown found his way to Deepak and surrendered his soul to Aaron Lake. "We've basically taken over his campaign," she said. "We're writing speeches, polling, doing all his print and TV ads. We even hired a new staff for him. So far, we've spent $1.5 million, and our boy has cut the lead to 10 points. And we have 7 months to go." In all, Tyner and Deepak were meddling in 30 House races and 10 in the Senate. She expected to raise a total of $60 million and spend every dime of it by November. Her third area of focus was taking the pulse of the country. Deepak was polling nonstop every day, 15 hours a day. If labor in western Pennsylvania was bothered by an issue, Deepak would know it. If the Hispanics in Houston were pleased with a new welfare policy, Deepak would know it. If the women in Greater Chicago liked or disliked a Lake ad, Deepak knew yes or no, and by what percentage. "We know everything," she boasted. "We're like Big Brother, always watching." The polling cost $60,000 a day, a bargain. No one could touch it. For the important matters, Lake was 9 points ahead of Terry in Texas, even in Florida, a state Lake had yet to visit, and very close in Indiana, Terry's home state. "Terry's tired," she said. "Morale is low because he won in New Hampshire and the money was rolling in. Then you came from nowhere, a fresh face, no baggage, new message. You start winning and suddenly the money finds you. Terry can't raise $50 at a church bake sale. He's losing key people because he can't pay them and because they smell another winner." Lake chewed a piece of pineapple and savored the words. They weren't new, he'd heard them from his own people, but coming from a seasoned insider like Tyner, they were even more reassuring. "What are the vice president's numbers?" Lake asked. He had his own set, but for some reason trusted hers more. "He'll squeak out the nomination," she said, offering nothing new, "but the convention will be bloody. Right now you're only a few points behind him on the big question. Who will you vote for in November?" "November is far away." "It is, and it isn't." "A lot can change," Lake said, thinking of Teddy, and wondering what sort of crisis he'd create to terrify the American people. The dinner was more of a snack, and from Mortimer's, Lake was driven to a small dining room at the Hay Adams Hotel. It was a long, late dinner with friends, 24 of his colleagues from the House. Few of them had rushed to endorse him when he'd entered the race, but now they were all wildly enthusiastic about their man. Most had their own pollsters. The bandwagon was rolling down the mountain. Lake had never seen his old pals so happy to be around him. The letter was prepared in documents by a woman named Bruce, one of the agency's three best counterfeiters. Tacked to the corkboard just above her work table in her small lab were a dozen letters written by Ricky. Excellent samples, much more than she needed. She had no idea who Ricky was, but there was no doubt his handwriting was contrived. It was fairly consistent with the more recent samples, clearly showing an ease that came only with practice. His vocabulary was not remarkable, but then she suspected he was trying to downplay it. His sentence structure showed few mistakes. Bruce guessed him to be between the ages of 40 and 60, with at least a college education. But it wasn't her job to make such inferences, at least not in this case. With the same pen and paper as Ricky, she wrote a nice little note to Al. The text had been prepared by someone else, she did not know who, nor did she care. It was, "Hey, Al, where you been? Why haven't you written? Don't forget about me." That kind of letter, but with a nice little surprise. Since Ricky couldn't use the phone, he was sending Al a cassette tape with a brief message from deep inside rehab. Bruce fit the letter onto one page, then worked for an hour on the envelope. The postmark she applied was from Neptune Beach, Florida. She didn't seal the envelope. Her little project was inspected, then taken to another lab. The tape was recorded by a young agent who'd studied drama at Northwestern. In a soft, accentless voice, he said,
Hey, Al, this is Ricky. Hope you're surprised to hear my voice. They won't let us use the phones around here. I don't know why, but for some reason we can send tapes back and forth. I can't wait to get out of this place. Then he rambled for 5 minutes about his rehab and how much he hated his uncle and the people who ran Aladdin North. But he did concede that they had rid him of his addictions. He was certain he would look back and not judge the place too harshly. His entire narrative was nothing but babble. No plans were discussed for his release, no hint of where he might go or what he might do, only a vague reference about seeing Al one day. They were not yet ready to bait Al Conyers. The sole purpose of the tape was to hide within its casing a transmitter strong enough to lead them to Lake's hidden file. A tiny bug in the envelope was too risky. Al might be smart enough to find it. At Mailbox America in Chevy Chase, the CIA now controlled 8 boxes, duly rented for 1 year by 8 different people, each of whom had the same 24-hour access that Mr. Conyers had. They came and went at all hours, checking their little boxes, picking up mail they'd sent themselves, occasionally taking a peek at Al's box if no one was looking. Since they knew his schedule better than he knew it himself, they waited patiently until he'd made his rounds. They felt certain he'd sneak out as before, dressed like a jogger, so they held the envelope with the tape until almost 10 one night. Then they placed it in his box. 4 hours later, with 12 agents watching every move, Lake the jogger jumped from a cab in front of Mailbox America, darted inside, his face hidden by the long bill of a running cap, went to his box, pulled out the mail, and hurried back into the cab. 6 hours later, he left Georgetown for a prayer breakfast at the Hilton, and they waited. He addressed an association of police chiefs at 9 and 1,000 high school principals at 11. He lunched with the Speaker of the House. He taped a stressful Q&A session with some talking heads at 3, then returned home to pack. His itinerary called for him to depart Reagan National at 8 and fly to Dallas. They followed him to the airport, watched the Boeing 707 take off, then called Langley. When the 2 Secret Service agents arrived to check the perimeter of Lake's townhouse, the CIA was already inside. The search ended in the kitchen 10 minutes after it began. A handheld receptor caught the signal from the cassette tape. They found it in the wastebasket, along with an empty half-gallon milk jug, 2 torn packages of oatmeal, some soiled paper towels, and that morning's edition of the Washington Post. A maid came 2 times a week. Lake had simply left the garbage for her to take care of. They couldn't find Lake's file because he didn't have one. Smart man, he tossed away the evidence. Teddy was almost relieved when he got word. The team was still in the townhouse, hiding and waiting for the Secret Service to leave. Whatever Lake did in his secret life, he worked hard not to leave a trail. The tape unnerved Aaron Lake. Reading Ricky's letters and looking at his handsome face had given him a nervous thrill. The young man was far away, and odds were they'd never meet. They could be pen pals and play tag at a distance and move slowly. At least that's what Lake had contemplated initially. But hearing Ricky's voice had brought him much closer, and Lake was rattled. What had begun a few months earlier as a curious little game now held horrible possibilities. It was much too risky. Lake trembled at the thought of getting caught. It still seemed impossible, though. He was well hidden behind the mask of Al Conyers. Ricky had not a clue. It was Al this and Al that on the tape. The post office box was his shield. But he had to end it, at least for now. The Boeing was packed with Lake's well-paid people. They didn't make an airplane big enough to haul his entire entourage. If he leased a 747, within 2 days it would be filled with CAs and advisors and consultants and pollsters, not to mention his own growing army of bodyguards from the Secret Service. The more primaries he won, the heavier his plane became. It might be wise to lose a couple of states so he could jettison some of the baggage. In the darkness of the plane, Lake sipped tomato juice
and decided to write a final letter to Ricky. Al would wish him the best and simply terminate the correspondence. What could the boy do? He was tempted to write the note right then, sitting in his deep recliner, his feet in the air. But at any moment, an assistant of some variety would emerge with another breathless report that the candidate had to hear immediately. He had no privacy. He had no time to think or loaf or daydream. Every pleasant thought was interrupted by a new poll or a late-breaking story or an urgent need to make a decision. Surely he'd be able to hide in the White House. Loners had lived there before. Chapter 21. The case of the stolen cell phone had fascinated the inmates at Trumbull for the past month. Mr. T-Bone, a wiry street kid from Miami serving 20 for drugs, had taken original possession of the phone by means that were still unclear. Cell phones were strictly prohibited at Trumbull, and the method by which he got one had created more rumors than T. Carl's sex life. The few who'd actually seen it had described it, not in court but around the camp, as being no larger than a stopwatch. Mr. T-Bone had been seen lurking in the shadows, hunched at the waist, chin to his chest, back to the world, mumbling into the phone. No doubt he was still directing street operations in Miami. Then it disappeared. Mr. T-Bone let it be known that he might kill whoever took it, and when the threats of violence didn't work, he offered a reward of $1,000 cash. Suspicion soon fell upon another young drug dealer, Zorro, from a section of Atlanta just as rough as Mr. T-Bone's. A killing seemed likely, so the guards and the suits up front intervened and convinced the two that they'd be shipped away if things got out of hand. Violence was not tolerated at Trumbull. The punishment was a trip to a medium security pen with inmates who understood violence. Someone told Mr. T-Bone about the weekly dockets the brethren held, and in due course he found T. Carl and filed suit. He wanted his phone back, plus $1 million in punitive damages. When it was first set for trial, an assistant warden appeared in the cafeteria to observe the proceedings, and the matter was quickly postponed by the brethren. The same thing happened just before the second trial. Allegations of who did or did not have possession of an outlawed cell phone could not be heard by anyone in administration. The guards, who watched the weekly shows, wouldn't repeat a word. Justice Spicer finally convinced a prison counselor that the boys had a private matter to reconcile without interference from the front. "We're trying to settle a little matter," he whispered, "and we need to do it in private." The request worked its way upward, and at the third trial date, the cafeteria was packed with spectators, most of whom were hoping to see bloodshed. The only prison official in the room was a solitary guard, sitting in the back half asleep. Neither of the litigants was a stranger to courtrooms, so it was no surprise that Mr. T-Bone and Zorro acted as their own attorneys. Justice Beach spent most of the first hour trying to keep the language out of the gutter. He finally gave up. Wild accusations spewed forth from the plaintiff, charges that couldn't have been proved with the aid of 1,000 FBI agents. The denials were just as loud and preposterous from the defense. Mr. T-Bone scored heavy blows with 2 affidavits, signed by inmates whose names were revealed only to the brethren, which contained eyewitness accounts of seeing Zorro trying to hide while talking on a tiny phone. Zorro's angry response described the affidavits in language the brethren had never before encountered. The knockout punch came from nowhere. Mr. T-Bone, in a move that even the slickest lawyer would admire, produced documentation. His phone records had been smuggled in, and he showed the court in black and white that exactly 54 calls had been made to numbers in southeast Atlanta. His supporters, by far the majority, but whose loyalty could vanish in an instant, whooped and hollered until T. Carl slammed his plastic gavel and got them quiet. Zorro had trouble regrouping, and his hesitation killed him. He was ordered to immediately turn over the phone to the brethren within 24 hours and to reimburse Mr. T-Bone $450 for long-distance charges. If 24 hours passed with no phone, the matter would be referred to the warden along with a finding of fact from the brethren that Zorro did indeed possess an illegal cell phone. The brethren further ordered the two to maintain a distance of at least 50 feet from one another at all times, even when eating. T. Carl rapped a gavel and the crowd began a noisy exit. He called the next case, another petty gambling dispute, and waited for the spectators to leave.
"Quiet!"
he shouted, and the racket only grew louder. The brethren went back to their newspapers and magazines.
"Quiet!"
he barked again, slamming his gavel.
"Shut up!"
Spicer yelled at T. Carl. "You're making more noise than they are!"
"It's my job!"
T. Carl snapped back, the curls of his wig bouncing in all directions. When the cafeteria was empty, only one inmate remained. T. Carl looked around and finally asked him,
"Are you Mr. Hooten?"
"No, sir," the young man said.
"Are you Mr. Jenkins?"
"No, sir."
"I didn't think so. The case of Hooten versus Jenkins is hereby dismissed for failure to show,"
T. Carl said, and made a dramatic entry into his docket book.
"Who are you?"
Spicer asked the young man, who was sitting alone and glancing around as if he wasn't sure he was welcome. The three men in the pale green robes were now looking at him, as was the clown with the gray wig and the old maroon pajamas and the lavender shower shoes, no socks. Who were these people? He slowly got to his feet and moved forward with great apprehension until he stood before the three.
"I'm looking for some help," he said, almost afraid to speak.
"Do you have business before the court?"
T. Carl growled from the side.
"No, sir."
"Then you'll have to shut up," Spicer said. "Court's adjourned. Leave."
T. Carl slammed his docket book, kicked back his folding chair, and stormed out of the room, his shower shoes sliding on the tile, his wig bouncing behind him. The young man appeared ready to cry.
"What can we do for you?" Yarber asked.
He was holding a small cardboard box, and the brethren knew from experience that it was filled with the papers that had brought him to Trumbull.
"I need some help," he said again.
"I got here last week and my roommate said you guys could help with my appeals."
"Don't you have a lawyer?" Beach asked.
"I did. He wasn't very good. He's one reason I'm here."
"Why are you here?" asked Spicer.
"I don't know. I really don't know."
"Did you have a trial?"
"Yes, a long one."
"And you were found guilty by a jury?"
"Yes, me and a bunch of others. They said we were part of a conspiracy."
"A conspiracy to do what?"
"Import cocaine."
Another druggie. They were suddenly anxious to get back to their letter writing.
"How long is your sentence?" asked Yarber.
48 years.
48 years? How old are you?
23.
The letter writing was momentarily forgotten. They looked at his sad young face and tried to picture it 50 years later. Released at the age of 71, it was impossible to imagine. Each of the brethren would leave Trumbull younger men than this kid.
"Pull up a chair," Yarber said,
and the kid grabbed the nearest one and placed it in front of their table. Even Spicer felt a little sympathy for him.
"What's your name?" Yarber asked.
"I go by Buster."
"Okay, Buster. What did you do to get yourself 48 years?
The story came in torrents. Balancing his box on his knees and staring at the floor, he began by saying he'd never been in trouble with the law, nor had his father. They owned a small boat dock together in Pensacola. They fished and sailed and loved the sea, and running the dock was the perfect life for them. They sold a used fishing boat, a 50-footer, to a man from Fort Lauderdale, an American who paid them in cash, $95,000. The money went in the bank, or at least Buster thought it did. A few months later, the man was back for another boat, a 38-footer, for which he paid $80,000. Cash for boats was not unusual in Florida. A third and fourth boat followed. Buster and his dad knew where to find good used fishing boats, which they overhauled and renovated. They enjoyed doing the work themselves. After the fifth boat, the narcs came calling.
They asked questions, made vague threats, wanted to see the books and records. Buster's dad refused initially, then they hired a lawyer who advised them not to cooperate. Nothing happened for months. Buster and his father were arrested at 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning by a pack of goons wearing vests and enough guns to hold Pensacola hostage. They were dragged half-dressed from their small home near the bay, lights flashing all over the place. The indictment was an inch thick, 160 pages, 81 counts of conspiracy to smuggle cocaine. He had a copy of it in his box. Buster and his dad were barely mentioned in the 160 pages, but they were nonetheless named as defendants and lumped together with the man they'd sold the boats to, along with 25 other people they'd never heard of. 11 were Colombians, 3 were lawyers. Everybody else was from South Florida. The U.S. attorney offered them a deal. 2 years each in return for guilty pleas and cooperation against the other co-defendants. Pleading guilty to what? They'd done nothing wrong. They knew exactly one of their other 25 co-conspirators. They'd never seen cocaine. Buster's father remortgaged their home to raise $20,000 for a lawyer, and they made a bad selection. At trial, they were alarmed to find themselves sitting at the same table with the Colombians and the real drug traffickers. They were all on one side of the courtroom, all the co-conspirators, sitting together as if they'd once been a well-oiled drug machine. On the other side, near the jury, were the government lawyers, groups of pompous little bastards in dark suits, taking notes, glaring at them as if they were all child molesters. The jury glared at them, too. During 7 weeks of trial, Buster and his father were practically ignored. 3 times, their names were mentioned. The government's principal charge against them was that they had conspired to procure and rebuild fishing boats with souped-up engines to transport drugs from Mexico to various drop-offs along the Florida Panhandle. Their lawyer, who complained that he wasn't getting paid enough to handle a 7-week trial, proved ineffective at rebutting these loose charges. Still, the government lawyers did little damage and were much more concerned with nailing the Colombians. But they didn't have to prove much. They had done a superior job of picking the jury. After 8 days of deliberation, the jurors, obviously tired and frustrated, found every conspirator guilty of all charges. A month after they were sentenced, Buster's father killed himself. As the narrative wound down, the kid looked as if he might cry. But he stuck out his jaw, gritted his teeth, and said, "I did nothing wrong." He certainly wasn't the first inmate at Trumbull to declare his innocence. Beach watched and listened, and remembered a young man he'd sentenced once to 40 years for drug trafficking back in Texas. The defendant had a rotten childhood, no education, a long record as a juvenile offender, not much of a chance in life. Beach had lectured him from the bench, high and lordly from above, and had felt good about himself for handing down such a brutal sentence. Gotta get these damn drug dealers off the streets. A liberal is a conservative who's been arrested. After 3 years on the inside of a prison, Hatley Beach agonized over many of the people he'd thrown the book at. People far guiltier than Buster here, kids who just needed a break. Finn Yarber watched and listened and felt immense pity for the young man. Everybody at Trumbull had a sad story, and after a month or so of hearing them, he'd learned to believe almost nothing. But Buster was believable. For the next 48 years, he would wither and decline, all at taxpayer expense. 3 meals a day, a warm bed at night, $31,000 a year was the latest guess of what a federal inmate cost the government. Such a waste. Half the inmates at Trumbull had no business being there. They were nonviolent men who should have been punished with stiff fines and community service. Joe Roy Spicer listened to Buster's compelling story, and he sized the boy up for future use. There were 2 possibilities. First, in Spicer's opinion, the telephones were not being properly utilized in the Angola scam. The brethren were old men writing letters as if they were young. It would be too risky to call Quince Garby in Iowa, for example, and pretend to be Ricky, a robust 28-year-old. But with a kid like Buster working for them, they could convince any potential victim. There were plenty of young guys at Trumbull, and Spicer had considered several of them. But they were criminals, and he didn't trust them. Buster was fresh off the streets, seemingly innocent, and he was coming to them for help. The boy could be manipulated. The second possibility was an offshoot of the first. If Buster joined their conspiracy, he would be in place when Joe Roy was released. The scam was proving too profitable to simply walk away from. Beach and Yarber were splendid at writing the letters, but they had no business sense. Perhaps Spicer could train young Buster here to fill his shoes and to divert his share to the outside. Just a thought. "Do you have any money?" Spicer asked.
"No, sir, we lost everything."
"No family, no uncles, aunts, cousins, friends who could help you with your legal fees?"
"No, sir." "What kind of legal fees?"
"We usually charge for reviewing cases and helping with the appeals."
"I'm dead broke, sir."
"I think we can help," Beach said. Spicer didn't work on the appeals anyway. The man never finished high school. "Sort of a pro bono case, wouldn't you say?" Yarber said to Beach.
"A pro what?"
Spicer asked.
"Pro bono."
"What's that?"
"Free legal work," Beach said.
"Free legal work, done by whom?"
"By lawyers," Yarber explained. "Every lawyer is expected to donate a few hours of his time to help people who can't afford to hire him."
"It's part of the old English common law," Beach added, further clouding the issue.
"It never caught on over here, did it?" Spicer said.
"We'll review your case," Yarber said to Buster. "But please do not be optimistic."
"Thank you."
They left the cafeteria in a group, three ex-judges in green choir robes, followed by a scared young inmate. Frightened, but also quite curious. Chapter 22. Brandt's reply from Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, had an urgent tone to it. "Dear Ricky, wow, what a photo. I'm coming down even sooner. I'll be there on April 20th. Are you available? If so, we'll have the house to ourselves because my wife will stay here for another 2 weeks. Poor woman. We've been married for 22 years and she doesn't have a clue. Here's a picture of me. That's my Learjet in the background, one of my favorite toys. We'll buzz around in it if you want. Write me immediately, please. Sincerely, Brandt." There was still no last name, not that that was a problem. They would dig for it soon enough. Spicer inspected the postmark, and for a passing moment thought about how quickly the mail was running between Jacksonville and Philadelphia. But the photo kept his attention. It was a 4x6 candid shot, very similar to an ad for a get-rich-quick scheme where the huckster is standing tall with a proud smile, flanked by his jet, his Rolls, and possibly his latest wife. Brandt was standing beside a plane, smiling, dressed neatly in tennis shorts and a sweater, with no Rolls in sight, but with an attractive middle-aged woman next to him. It was the first photo in their growing collection in which one of their pen pals had included his wife. Odd, thought Spicer, but then Brandt had mentioned her in both letters. Nothing surprised him anymore. The scam would work forever because there was an endless supply of potential victims willing to ignore the risks. Brandt himself was fit and tanned, short dark hair with shades of gray and a mustache. He was not particularly handsome, but what did Spicer care? Why would a man with so much be so careless? Because he'd always taken chances and never been caught. Because it was a way of life. And after they squeezed him and took his money, Brandt would slow down for a while. He'd avoid the personal ads and the anonymous lovers. But an aggressive type like Brandt would soon return to his old ways. Spicer figured the thrill of finding random partners overshadowed the risks. He was still bothered by the fact that he, of all people, spent time each day trying to think like a homosexual. Beach and Yarber read the letter and studied the photo.
The small, cramped room was completely silent. Could this be the big one?
"Reckon how much that jet cost," Spicer said, and all three laughed. It was nervous laughter, as if they weren't sure they could believe it.
"A couple of million," Beach said. Being from Texas and formerly married to a rich woman, the other two assumed he knew more about jets than they.
"It's a small Lear."
Spicer would settle for a small Cessna, anything that would lift him off the ground and take him away. Yarbrough didn't want a plane. He wanted tickets in first class where they brought you champagne and two menus and you had your choice of movies. First class, over the ocean, far away from this country.
"Let's bust him," Yarbrough said.
"How much?" asked Beach, still staring at the photo.
"At least $500,000, Spicer said. "And if we get that, we'll go back for more."
They sat in silence, each playing with his portion of $500,000. Trevor's third was suddenly getting in the way. He'd take $167,000 off the top, leaving each of them $111,000. Not bad for prisoners, but it should be a hell of a lot more. Why was the lawyer making so much?
"We're going to cut Trevor's fee," Spicer announced. "I've been thinking about this for some time. Beginning now, the money will be split four ways. He takes an equal share."
"He won't do it," Yarbrough said.
"He has no choice."
"It's only fair," Beach said. "We're doing the work and he's getting more than each of us. I say we cut it."
"I'll do it Thursday."
2 days later, Trevor arrived at Trumbull just after four with a particularly bad hangover, one deadened neither by the two-hour lunch nor the one-hour nap. Joe Roy seemed particularly edgy. He passed across the outgoing mail, but held a large red oversized envelope.
"We're getting ready to bust this guy," he said, tapping it on the table.
"Who is he?"
"Brandt, somebody, near Philadelphia. He's hiding behind the post office, so you need to flush him out."
"How much?"
$500,000.
Trevor's red eyes narrowed and his dry lips fell open. He did the math, $167,000 in his pocket. His sailing career was suddenly drawing closer. Perhaps he didn't need a full $1,000,000 before he slammed his office door and left for the Caribbean. Maybe half that would do it. And he was getting so close.
"You're kidding," he said,
knowing that Spicer was not. Spicer had no sense of humor, and he certainly took his money seriously.
"No. And we're changing your percentage."
"I'll be damned if we are. A deal's a deal."
"Deals can always be changed. From now on, you get the same piece we do, 1/4.
"No way."
"Then you're fired."
"You can't fire me."
"I just did."
"What?
You think we can't find another crooked lawyer to run mail for us?"
"I know too much," Trevor said, his cheeks flashing pink and his tongue suddenly parched.
"Don't overestimate yourself. You're not that valuable."
"Yes, I am. I know everything that's going on here."
"And so do we, hotshot. Difference is, we're already in jail. You're the one with the most to lose. You play hardball with me and you'll be sitting on this side of the table."
Bolts of pain shot through Trevor's forehead and he closed his eyes. He was in no condition to argue. Why had he stayed at Pete's so late last night? He had to be sharp when he met with Spicer. Instead, he was tired and half drunk. His head spun and he thought he might be sick again. He did the math. They were arguing over the difference between $167,000 and $125,000. Frankly, both sounded good to Trevor. He couldn't run the risk of being fired, because he'd managed to alienate what few clients he had. He spent less time in the office, he wouldn't return their calls. He'd found a far richer source of income, so to hell with the small-time foot traffic along the beaches. And he was no match for Spicer. The man had no conscience. He was mean and conniving and desperate to stash away as much money as possible. "Are Beach and Yarbrough in favor of this?" he asked, knowing damned well they were, and knowing that even if they weren't, he'd never know the difference.
Sure, they're doing all the work. Why should you make more than them?
It did seem a little unfair.
Okay, okay, Trevor said, still in pain. There's a good reason you're in prison.
Are you drinking too much?
No, why do you ask?
I've known drunks, lots of them. You look like hell.
Thanks. You take care of your business, I'll take care of mine.
It's a deal. But nobody wants a drunk for a lawyer. You're handling all our money in an enterprise that's very illegal. A little loose talk in a bar and somebody starts asking questions.
I can handle myself.
Good. Watch your back, too. We're squeezing people, making them hurt. If I were on the other end of our little sting, I'd be tempted to come down and try to get some answers before I coughed up the money.
They're too scared.
Keep your eyes open anyway. It's important for you to stay sober and alert.
Thank you very much. Anything else?
Yeah, I've got some games for you.
On to the important stuff. Spicer opened a newspaper and they began making their bets. Trevor bought a quart of beer at a country store on the edge of Trumbull and sipped it slowly as he puttered back to Jacksonville. He tried his best not to think of their money, but his thoughts were out of control. Between his account and their account, there was just over $250,000 sitting offshore, money he could take any time he wanted. Add $500,000 to it and, well, he just couldn't stop adding. $750,000. He'd never get caught stealing dirty money. That was the beauty of it. The victims of the Brethren weren't complaining now because they were too ashamed. They weren't breaking any laws. They were just scared. The Brethren, on the other hand, were committing crimes. So who would they run to if their money disappeared? He had to stop thinking such thoughts. But how could they, the Brethren, catch him? He'd be on a sailboat, drifting between islands they'd never heard of. And when they were finally released, would they have the energy and money and willpower to track him down? Of course not. They were old men. Beach would probably die at Trumbull.
Stop it! He yelled at himself.
He walked to Beach Java for a triple shot latte and returned to his office, determined to do something productive. He went online and found the names of several private investigators in Philadelphia. It was almost 6 when he began calling. The first 2 went to answering machines. The 3rd, to the offices of Ed Pagnozzi, was answered by the investigator himself. Trevor explained that he was a lawyer in Florida and needed a quick job in Upper Darby.
Okay, what kind of job?
I'm trying to track some mail here, Trevor said glibly. He'd done this enough to have it well rehearsed. Pretty big divorce case. I got the wife, and I think the husband's hiding money. Anyway, I need somebody up there to find out who's renting a certain post office box.
You gotta be kidding.
Well, no, I'm pretty serious about this. You want me to go snooping around a post office? It's just basic detective work. Look, pal, I'm very busy. Call somebody else.
Pagnozzi was gone, off to more important matters. Trevor cursed him under his breath and punched the next number. He tried 2 more and hung up on both when the machines answered. He'd try again tomorrow. Across the street, Klockner listened to the brief chat with Pagnozzi 1 more time, then called Langley. The final piece of the puzzle had just fallen into place, and Mr. DeVille would want to know it immediately. While dependent on fancy words and smooth talk and compelling photos, the scam was basic in its operation. It preyed on human desire, and it paid off by sheer terror. Its mechanics had been solved by Mr. Garby's file and by the Brant White reverse scam, and by the other letters they'd intercepted. Only 1 question had gone unanswered. When aliases were used to rent post office boxes, how did the Brethren find the real names of their victims? The phone calls to Philadelphia had just given them their answer. Trevor simply hired a local private detective, evidently one with less business than Mr. Pagnozzi. It was almost 10 when DeVille was finally cleared to see Teddy. The North Koreans had shot another American soldier in the DMZ, and Teddy had been dealing with the fallout since noon.
He was eating cheese and crackers and sipping a Diet Coke when DeVille entered the bunker. After a quick briefing, Teddy said,
"That's what I thought."
His instincts were uncanny, especially with hindsight. This means, of course, that the lawyer could hire a local here to somehow uncover the real identity of Al Conyers, DeVille said.
But how?
We can think of several ways. First is surveillance, the same way we caught Lake sneaking to his box. Watch the post office. That's somewhat risky because there's a good chance you'll get noticed. Second is bribery. $500 cash to a postal clerk will work in a lot of places. Third is computer records. This is not highly classified material. One of our guys just hacked his way into the central post office in Evansville, Indiana, and got the list of all box leases. It was a random test. Took him about an hour. That's high tech. Low tech is to simply break in the post office at night and have a look around.
How much does he pay for this?
Don't know, but we'll find out soon when he hires an investigator.
He has to be neutralized.
Eliminated?
Not yet.
I'd rather buy him first. He is our window. If he's working for us, then we know everything and we keep him away from Conyers. Put together a plan. And for his removal?
Go ahead and plan it, but we're in no hurry. Not yet, anyway.
Chapter 23. The South did indeed like Aaron Lake, with his love of guns and bombs and tough talk and military readiness. He flooded Florida, Mississippi, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and Texas with ads that were even bolder than his first ones. And Teddy's people flooded the same states with more cash than had ever changed hands the night before an election. The result was another rout, with Lake getting 260 of the 312 delegates at stake on Little Super Tuesday. After the votes were counted on March 14th, 1,301 of the 2,066 total delegates had been decided. Lake held a commanding lead over Governor Terry, 801 to 390. The race was over, barring an unforeseen catastrophe. Buster's first job at Trumbull was running a weed eater, for which he earned a starting wage of 20 cents an hour. It was either that or mopping floors in the cafeteria. He chose the weed eating because he liked the sun and vowed that his skin would not turn as pale as some of the bleached-out inmates he'd seen. Nor would he get fat, like some of them. This is prison, he kept telling himself. How can they be so fat? He worked hard in the bright sun, kept his tan, vowed to keep his flat stomach, and tried gamely to go through the motions. But after 10 days, Buster knew he would not last for 48 years. 48 years! He couldn't begin to comprehend such time. Who could? He'd cried for the first 48 hours. 13 months earlier, he and his father were running their dock, working on boats, fishing twice a week in the Gulf. He worked slowly around the concrete edge of the basketball court where a rowdy game was in progress, then to the big sandbox where they sometimes played volleyball. In the distance, a solitary figure was walking around the track. An old-looking man with his long gray hair in a ponytail and with no shirt. He looked vaguely familiar. Buster worked both edges of a sidewalk, making his way to the track. The lone walker was Mr. Yarber, one of the judges who was trying to help him. He moved around the oval at a steady pace, head level, back and shoulders stiff and erect, not a picture of athleticism, but not bad for a 60-year-old man. He was barefoot and bare-backed, sweat rolling off his leathery skin. Buster turned off the weed-eater and placed it on the ground. When Mr. Yarber drew near, he saw the kid and said, "Hello, Buster, how's it going?" "I'm still here," the kid said. "Mind if I walk with you?" "Not at all," Finn said without breaking stride. They did an eighth of a mile before Buster could find the courage to say, "So how about my appeals?" "Judge Beach is looking at it. The sentencing appears to be in order, which is not good news."
A lot of guys get here with flaws in their sentencing, and we can usually file a couple of motions and knock off a few years. Not so with you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. What's a few when you have 48? 28, 38, 48, what does it matter?
You still have your appeals. There's a chance the conviction can be overturned.
A slim chance.
You can't give up hope, Buster, Yarber said, without the slightest trace of conviction. Keeping some measure of hope meant keeping some faith in the system. Yarber certainly had none. He'd been framed and railroaded by the same law he'd once defended. But at least Yarber had enemies, and he could almost understand why they came after him. This poor boy had done nothing wrong. Yarber had read enough of his file to believe Buster was completely innocent, another victim of an overzealous prosecutor. It appeared, at least from the record, that the kid's father may have been hiding some cash, but nothing serious, nothing to warrant a 160-page conspiracy indictment. Hope. He felt like a hypocrite for even thinking the word. The appeals courts were now packed with right-wing law and order types, and it was a rare drug case that got reversed. They'd slam-dunk the kid's appeal with a rubber stamp and tell themselves they were making the streets safer. The biggest coward had been the trial judge. Prosecutors are expected to indict the world, but the judges are supposed to weed out the fringe defendants. Buster and his father should have been separated from the Colombians and their cohorts and sent home before the trial began. Now one was dead, the other was ruined, and nobody in the federal criminal system gave a damn. It was just another drug conspiracy. At the first curve of the oval, Yarber slowed, then stopped. He looked off in the distance, beyond a grassy field, to the edge of a tree line. Buster looked too. For 10 days he'd been looking at the perimeter of Trumbull and seeing what wasn't there, fences, razor wire, guard towers. Last guy who left here, Yarber said, gazing at nothing, left through those trees. They're thick for a few miles, then you come to a country road.
Who was he?
A guy named Tommy Adkins. He was a banker in North Carolina, got caught with his hand in the cookie jar.
What happened to him?
He went crazy and walked away one day. He was gone 6 hours before anybody knew it. A month later, they found him in a motel room in Cocoa Beach, not the cops, but the maids. He was curled in the fetal position on the floor, naked, sucking his thumb, his mind completely gone. They put him in some mental joint.
6 hours, huh?
Yeah, it happens about once a year. Somebody just walks away. They notify the cops in your hometown, put your name in the national computers, the usual drill.
How many get caught?
Almost all.
Almost?
Yeah, but they get caught because they do dumb things. Get drunk in bars, drive cars with no taillights, go see their girlfriends.
So, if you had a brain, you could pull it off?
Sure. Careful planning, a little cash, it would be easy.
They began walking again, a little slower.
Tell me something, Mr. Yarber, Buster said. If you were facing 48 years, would you take a walk?
Yes.
But I don't have a dime.
I do.
Then you'll help me.
We'll see.
Give it some time. Settle in here. They're watching you a bit closer because you're new, but with time, they'll forget about you.
Buster actually smiled. His sentence had just been reduced dramatically.
You know what happens if you get caught, Yarber said.
Yeah, they add some more years. Big deal. Maybe I'll get 58.
No, sir, if I get caught, I'll blow my brains out.
That's what I do.
You have to be prepared to leave the country.
And go where?
Go someplace where you look like the locals and where they don't extradite to the U.S.
Any place in particular?
Argentina or Chile. You speak any Spanish?
No.
Start learning. We have Spanish lessons here, you know. Some of the Miami boys teach them.
They walked a lap in silence as Buster reconsidered his future. His feet were lighter, his shoulders straighter, and he couldn't keep a grin off his face.
Why are you helping me?
He asked.
This book is continued on Disc 7.